Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is a republic if you can keep it. Political news and commentary with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer.
I'm Jeff Timmer. Welcome to the Mar-a-Lago garage sale edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It. The man who once claimed a net worth of more than $10 billion says he can't come up with a measly half billion to satisfy a New York court judgment. If he's so rich, why can't he simply mortgage one of his many, 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 many amazing properties? On the plus side for the former game show host, it appears that the judge in his trial for stealing top secret documents is totally in his hip pocket.
I'm Walt Sorg, sitting in for Mark Brewer, who remains on vacation and isn't even checking his email, to which I say, bravo, Mark. Michigan Supreme Court Justice David Viviano shakes up the state a little bit, saying he won't seek re-election, giving Democrats a chance to solidify their majority on the officially but not really nonpartisan court. The UAW makes an endorsement in one of the key congressional races in Michigan, the race on the Democratic side, to succeed Dan Kildee in Congress. This week marks the 14th anniversary of the signing of Obamacare. State Democrats are turning up the heat in federal races, going after Republican candidates who opposed Obamacare then and in many cases continue to oppose it now. And the legislature ends the Michigan ban on surrogacy contracts and in the process protects in vitro fertilization. We're also going to talk about rural politics, which has become a one-sided debate, Jeff. It's all Republican. A book out there called White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy, is very controversial, very provocative, and we'll be talking with the authors of that book a little bit later in the podcast. Let's begin, though, with these two Michigan political stories. First, the retirement of David Viviano, a Republican-nominated justice on the Supreme Court, who I've got to admit I've got a kind of a soft spot for him because he was a key vote for us back in the Voters Not Politicians days when we were trying to get on the ballot. Without his vote, we wouldn't have been on the ballot.
Yeah, quite a surprising development here, an open seat, the Supreme Court. Usually, what it seems like happens is the justices wait until the next gubernatorial elections. If they're sitting in the party that's out of power in the gubernatorial mansion, would wait until after 2026, in this case, a Republican nominated justice. The fact that he is retiring, going to open up the seat, give the Democrats very realistic chance of capturing another seat and solidifying their majority on the court is before us here. And what's really a rare thing in Michigan politics that an incumbent justice loses. It's happened in just a handful of times, at least in modern times, post-World War II. And so it's a surprise. He's still a young guy. I've known David since before he was a judge down in Macomb County. He was very active in Republican politics in Macomb County. Comes from the sane wing of the Republican Party when there used to be such a thing. Has been a solid center-right conservative justice on the court where he stands and where he's coming from, but he's also been part of many interesting coalitions and opinions on the court over time as well, as you mentioned in the case with the Voters Not Politicians petition way back when.
It does seem to make life easier for Justice Kira Harris Bolden, who was appointed to the court by the governor and has to run to finish out the term that she was appointed to, so she'd have four more years on the court. It looks like the Republicans are really going to have to focus now on this open seat because it gives them better odds of at least winning one of the two.
Yeah. Now, when you look at the climate next fall, these races often follow the partisan outcome of the top of the ticket. Not always, but what we're looking at here in Michigan is likely to be a very close race in the presidential. So I would say it gives the Democrats a chance, by no means a certainty. Even if Joe Biden wins, it's likely to be a relatively narrow win. Same if Donald Trump were to happen to win Michigan. And so expect to see a tremendous amount of spending in this race. I think you're right, though, in your assessment. Justice Olin, comes off the table as the intense spending race. And that now shifts to this open seat where there will be no one running with the incumbency designation on the ballot. That's the thing. I don't know if it's how unique it is to Michigan, but it's in Michigan, incumbent judges and justices have that designation on the ballot, and it gives them an inherent advantage. And she will have that, and the other candidates won't. The thing that the Republicans are going to have to contend with is the fact that they've got to get a candidate nominated at a convention that is going to be nearly completely filled with delegates who are batshit crazy. I saw Court of Appeals Justice Mark Boonstra has announced he is running. State Representative Andrew Fink is running as well. And Boonstra has announced for the open seat. It will be interesting to see if Fink changes what he's running for, who else may join the fray. But the likelihood that a Republican convention is going to nominate somebody who isn't completely batshit crazy is very low. You could see a Matt DiPerno jump into the Supreme Court race, no shit, and become the odds-on favorite to get the nomination. And that would change the political dynamic from one that could be very close to one that would give the Democratic nominee a very clear and decisive advantage.
Let's move over to the other big political story in the state this week. The UAW weighing in on the race for the Democratic nomination to succeed Dan Kildee in Congress, coming out for State Senator Kristen McDonald-Rivett. Does that pretty much end things?
I don't know if it ends things, but since the day Dan Kildee has announced his retirement, she has been the odds-on favorite to get the nomination. She checks all the boxes on paper and I think on the field of campaigning. She has the it. That's been evident since she launched her bid for that competitive state Senate seat back in 2022. She comes from the right part of the district. She has won a very competitive race. It is firmly on the progressive side of the political spectrum, but very tethered to the center of ideological scale. I think that between the forces in Washington that want to make sure that seat stays in the Democratic column, coupled with those same forces in the state like the UAW, she's going to have a tremendous resource advantage. She's going to have a tremendous political advantage, practical advantage, because her opponents are largely centered with political bases in Genesee County, which is not her political base. So that's the largest voting block in the county, but they're going to split that up between them while she'll coast elsewhere. I think this is all lining up to be a very, very decisive win for McDonald-Rivett, the same way that the U.S. Senate primary is going to be a decisive win for Alyssa Slotkin. She's just far out ahead of everybody else. And McDonald-Rivett is the Slotkin in the congressional race.
As I noted in the open, I think the other big issue could again be health care. You take health care and reproductive rights, and those are the two issues the Democrats have been riding on now for almost a decade. And it seems like they aren't going away, which has got to make them happy over at Hart Kennedy House.
Yeah, I agree completely. Healthcare and access to healthcare and affordability of healthcare is going to be a huge, huge gift for Democratic candidates, a huge albatross for Republican candidates. But I think also factoring into the mix is going to be Social Security and Medicare, where the Republicans are having a pitched battle within the House and Senate caucuses on how high to raise the retirement age. They want to take away Social Security for people of a certain age and make you work until you're maybe 75 under some proposals in order to be able to get Social Security and Medicare. And I really think it's a huge vulnerability for the Democrats to exploit. You've got Donald Trump out there saying, well, we don't really want to touch health care. We don't want to touch Medicare and Social Security. But you've got the candidates to replace Mitch McConnell talking about how high they're going to raise the age. You've got proposals coming out of the House Republicans and the Freedom Caucus there about how high they're going to raise the retirement age. I think this is shaping up to be a potential convergence of all kind, the perfect storm for Democrats to really wedge votes away from Republicans among certainly baby boomers, where the Republicans have had an advantage.
Well, and certainly blue collar baby boomers too, because it's when your job's physically demanding, you don't want to work till you're 75. I could do podcasts until I'm 90. I'm just sitting at a desk in my home office and it's a piece of cake. But if I was working the assembly line at some manufacturing plant, that's a different animal.
Yeah, well, I'm not quite 60 yet, and people wish I would stop doing podcasts, but that's neither here nor there. I think, though, that it's going to become an issue, and one that will harm Republicans on the margins with baby boomers and older Gen Xers. Gen Xers have been the bread and butter of the MAGA vote for Trump. And I think that a campaign that centers on things like Medicare and Social Security are going to be just a minute here for Republicans, much like myself, who are looking at this going, I don't know that I voted for these Republicans and I've even voted for Trump, but I don't know that I'm going to vote for Tom Barrett in his race against Curtis Hertel if he's going to be telling me I've got to work till I'm 75 now in order to get those benefits that I was expecting.
Before we get to our guests, I want to do a little promotion on behalf of the Democratic Party. Not that they were paid to do that, but I find the subject really interesting. We're going to be talking about in just a few minutes, and that is the disconnect between Democrats and rural America. And the Democrats in Michigan are really making an effort to reach out to rural America, or rural Michigan at least, having a summit next month to talk about how do we reconnect with people who historically we represented and did very well with.
Yeah, I think it's the rural white vote for Republicans has become something that has grown large. It's now approaching 8 out of 10 votes in many areas go to the Republican candidates. It's what the urban black vote has been for the Democrats. And there's a real risk that the Republicans are taking it for granted. They're not spending time and resources where they've been cleaning up. And it does provide some opportunity for an organized effort, because the political motivation hasn't been a diehard partisan identity. It's been born more out of economic populism. And I think the Democrats, if they play this right, do have an opportunity to gain back some votes. It's not going to be a seismic shift, but if instead of 8 out of 10 votes in some of these rural counties in Michigan, they're getting 70% or 2/3 of the vote, margins make a difference.
Alyssa Slotkin called that losing better.
Yeah. And hats off to Lavora Barnes in her 83 county effort that the Democratic Party in Michigan has been implementing over these last few elections. I think that it is go after every available vote wherever they are. And I've encountered them, some very motivated Democratic activists in these rural areas. I'll be at that summit that you mentioned. Mark and I will be speaking there. And I think it's a sign that Democrats, the pro-democracy forces in Michigan, are going to give no quarter, leave no stone unturned. And I think that bodes well for the pro-democracy candidates up and down the ballot.
We can't leave this segment without commenting at least a little bit on our favorite former president and game show host and his financial problems these days. Trump he's really in a box, even though this new public offering now with his failing social media project, the stock is just so completely overvalued, in large part because the people that love Donald Trump are buying up the stock.
Yeah, well, what we're going to see is, pending a an emergency court action here in the next really 48 hours or so. Monday morning, we're probably going to see Letitia James, the attorney general in New York, take action to begin to seize one or more Trump properties to cover this judgment against Trump. He's always been smoke and mirrors. His wealth has always been jazz hands. He's leveraged to the hilt. His net worth has never been what he's claimed it is. And that's being exposed now. He doesn't have the ability to cover this, and it's going to end up costing him property that he's going to lose forever. And it's going to be the beginning of the dominoes that are going to fall in Trump's financial life. Temporarily, he may see a boost in his paper value when it comes to this Truth Social merger and IPO that is happening, but it's not likely that that IPO range that they're expecting here is going to last when people with that stock might be very, very, very overvalued in the market. And his $3 billion personal stake that has been written about today could evaporate very, very quickly. And that $3 billion is not necessarily cash infusion into Donald Trump either. He would have to receive company waivers and perhaps waivers from the SEC in order to divest himself of that stock in order to get a cash influx from any of it.
One thing in the back of my very suspicious mind that just keeps reoccurring is the fact that his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, controls $2 billion of Saudi Arabian investment money. And what's to stop Jared from investing in a loan to his father-in-law?
That I would have no idea what kind of liquidity that money has or what kind of prohibitions would be on something like that. Just couldn't answer that. That's worth exploring. And I saw along those lines, there was Kushner was linked to a $500 million deal with Serbian investors, the most pro-Russian of the Balkan states. What this underscores is how dangerous it is to put Donald Trump in position of power, because he checks all the boxes. Donald Trump could never, ever, ever get security clearance if he was a civilian applying for a job that required security clearance, because he is desperate for cash and he would be a target for foreign intelligence services. He would be considered a high, almost definite risk. And if he was a civilian or a military contractor that had his kind of financial struggles and exposure, yet here 75 million people in the country are willing to turn over the nuclear secrets to a guy who is an intelligence risk and may have already sold intelligence.
The authors of White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy, join the conversation after these messages on A Republic, If You Can Keep It.
Epic MRA is pleased to sponsor this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and public policy issues.
Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, all levels of state and local government, and membership organizations. For the November 2022 election, Epic MRA published the most accurate final pre-election poll among several state and national polling firms.
Our polls most closely predicted the actual election results in races for governor, secretary of state, and attorney general, as well as the three ballot proposals.
Epic MRA is clearly the go-to polling firm in Michigan. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Ben Franklin may have invented the Franklin stove to stay warm, but we go Ben one better. We have the Ben Franklin hoodie dedicated to Americans for sanity. But wait, there's more. Our merch store has coffee mugs for Democrats, uncrazy Republicans, and free-thinking independents, as well as t-shirts for the discerning democracy lover. Just click on the Merch Center link on our homepage, arepublicpodcast.com. Show your support for political sanity at the podcast merch store. It's your duty as an American.
One of the many signs of a nation divided politically, while Democrats dominate in the cities, rural areas in Michigan and the nation vote overwhelmingly for Republicans. Michigan Democrats are ramping up their efforts to reverse the rural outcome, or at least cut into it. Next month, the state party's rural caucus will hold a two-day conference focused on the rural vote. Among those leading the discussions will be Senator Debbie Stabenow, who is the chair of the Senate Agriculture Committee and one of the few Democrats who has been endorsed regularly by Michigan Farm Bureau.
We're joined this week by the authors of a fascinating analysis of rural politics. White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy, is written by journalist Paul Waldman, who is a former columnist for The Washington Post, The Week, and The American Prospect. He is currently an MSNBC columnist, writes the cross-section newsletter, and co-hosts the Boundary Issues podcast.
His co-author is Tom Schaller. He's a professor of political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, a former columnist for the Baltimore Sun. He has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times. He is the author or co-author of four other books, including Common Enemies, The Stronghold, and Whistling Past Dixie. And after reading up on those books, I think I'm going to buy all three of them because they look absolutely fascinating as political treatises.
Thank you for joining us, and certainly a perilous time for American democracy, our politics, our culture. You examined this in a really interesting take on the what's going on in the rural areas, the white rural voters, the white rural outrage, and the way maybe some have gone from discontent to extremism, all the way to the point of radicalism. Tell us a bit about your book and where we're at and how we got here.
Tom, do you want to start with that one?
Look, let's be clear, because I can come out a little hot sometimes. We're not talking about every white rural American. And the things that we talk about in the book in terms of what we're really talking about is resentment, but rage makes for a better title. Publishers and editors like single syllable words, short punchy titles. So we got it down to three words and four syllables. But resentment is a phenomena in the literature, in the sociological and political science literature, measured and operationalized. And there are a lot of scholars that look at rural resentment and what drives it and what effects it has on people's attitudes. That resentment, like we said, does not pertain to every single white rural American. And there are plenty of people who have racist and xenophobic and conspiratorial attitudes outside of rural America, whether they're white, black, or brown, or whether they live in the suburbs or the cities. But basically what we found was that when you look at a lot of polls, not every issue, but many issues, when you look at who's at the least likely to support or most likely to support or highest rate or lowest rate in terms of valuing on a feeling thermometer, Black Lives Matter or something, that white rural Americans were often the superlative group. Least likely to support gay rights, least likely to agree that immigrants strengthen our society, most likely to support and justify Trump being returned to office by force, things like that. And there's a lot of reasons why rural resentments are peaking right now. And we spend the middle four chapters of the book talking a lot about that. It really starts with economic decay, population losses. Two-thirds of rural counties lost population between 2010 and 2020. There's a huge brain drain that young kids from rural communities are leaving. And in fact, 60% of rural adults tell their kids to leave. And then there's healthcare issues, which are both medical issues and personal health metrics, but also disappearing and shuttering hospitals and drug and alcohol treatment facilities, pharmacies closing. And so the state of rural America, for white rural Americans as well as minorities, is dealing with a late stage capitalist shock. And you add into that the politics of our nation right now, which is very polarized, and white voters vote disproportionately Republican and Trump, and rural voters do as well. And so the white rural voter is the base of the Trump MAGA movement. And we thought it was important to point this out at a moment of great constitutional and democratic peril. And so while many people are responding to the book quite negatively and feel it's a little unfair or a ferocious attack or a stereotyping, if we are in fact, and I'm not sure that we are, but if we are in fact on the precipice of our last free and fair election this fall, And we are not willing to identify not just MAGA and Trump, but specific groups of people by name as not the entire coalition, but we refer to as the tip of the spear or the leading edge of that coalition. I think we endanger ourselves by not naming the problem. And Paul and I basically do that. And it was a hard thing to write, to be perfectly honest with you, but we thought it was important to write it at this particular moment.
Tensions between rural and urban people are present all over the world, and probably since the invention of cities, you have seen that. But one thing that distinguishes the United States is the kind of extra political power that rural people here have. Through things like the design of the U.S. Senate, where rural states get the same representation as highly urbanized states with a lot more population. Through gerrymandering at the House level, which is something that people don't really think about. Everybody knows the Senate. Yes, Wyoming, 600,000 people get the same representation as California's 39 million. But I think a lot of people don't realize that the House also weights rural districts much more heavily. If you look at, there's a really nice classification system that was done by Bloomberg City Lab, where they classify every district using census data down to the census tract level as either fully rural, a rural suburban mix, all the way up to fully urban. And 42% of the districts in the United States House are either completely rural or a rural suburban mix. So that's, and only 19% are completely urban or an urban suburban mix, even though more people live in cities. So there are ways like that, that their power is leveraged up. And then there are ways within states through gerrymandering and other things that have the same effect. But one of the things we argue is that they have all this extra power at the ballot box, but that hasn't really translated into more improvements for their communities and their lives. And we have some things to say about why that is and the nature of rural politics. But that's I think, a key element, that there is something unique about the American rural voter that isn't necessarily present in other countries.
Was there a critical event that launched the move to more disunity between rural and non-rural America? Or has it just been a gradual growth over the years?
It has been gradual. You want to go ahead and answer, Tom? That's fine.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think culture war politics has moved to the center. And we can talk about social media and the disintermediation of our national conversation. And people are siloed with their own Twitter followers and their own Facebook friends and their own search engine results and so forth. But I think it's hard not to come back to race. I agree, and I think Paul does as well, with Ezra Klein's book, Why We're Polarized. And he says the single driving factor is the rapid demographic change of the country. And if you're white and rural, and you've been the dominant sort of voting bloc since the rise of Jacksonian democracy in the 1830s and 1840s, a country that was majority rural until the 1920 census. And even when you slipped into the minority, you were still very much a vibrant part of the coalition, say, of the New Deal. And now suddenly the calculus has changed. And Paul's right. Rural voters have inflated power in the House and the Senate, and obviously in the Electoral College as well. Just ask President Hillary Clinton or President Al Gore. But it is true that they are a shrinking share of the population, about 15% of the population, and 20% rural, counting the 5% who are rural non-whites. And it's clear from all the literature, from people like Catherine Kramer and her book, The Politics of Resentment in Wisconsin, that they believe that cities are moving away and moving farther ahead, and they're being left behind, which is Robert Wuthnow's book, borrowing the language from the 1967 Lyndon B. Johnson National Study on Rural America, called, which uses the title The Left Behind, the people that left behind in 1967. And there's truth to that. Technologically, the country is moving more towards cities and suburbs. Traditional extractive industries like agriculture and mining are disappearing. The new economy favors people in densely populated areas. And so there are perfectly legitimate reasons why rural Americans, whatever their color, feel like the country and progress is moving, not entirely without them, but maybe moving farther ahead, and that they lag behind, and they have to make a decision about abandoning the communities that they love and maybe have lived in for multiple generations to move to the suburbs or cities. And many of them may not want to do that. And older retirees who have Social Security and paid off their homes can't afford to stay. But middle-aged families and certainly young people have begun to say, I would love to live here, but maybe I need to move to the cities and suburbs, get a degree, and never come home.
Yeah, if you look at the data about voting patterns, we guess that for a long time, Republicans only did maybe a little bit better in rural areas, maybe by a couple of points, up until about 20 years ago. And that's when the lines really started to diverge. And with each subsequent election, especially lately, you've seen rural voters, especially rural whites, vote more and more Republican. So it's something that has been increasing each year. So for instance, Donald Trump got 62% of the rural white vote in 2016. In 2020, he got 71%. And then 2 years later in 2022, Republican House candidates got, I think, 74%. So that gap keeps getting wider and wider.
You know, one of the things that has fascinated me about watching this fairly seismic realignment and with our partisan coalition, and I came up, I was as establishment Republican not that long ago as anybody, in watching and examining what happened and how we got here. One element that keeps coming to mind to me is certainly the socioeconomic forces that you're talking about here. But one other, and I just am curious if this came up in your examination of this topic for your book, religiosity and specifically weaponized evangelicals added on to the top, out of this economic discomfort, the malaise, the xenophobia, whatever it is, that seems like that we might have been a catalytic element that kind of sent this into the stratosphere. The way that evangelical Christianism has morphed into Trumpism.
Yeah, there's a funny irony about all of that because Trump, of course, doesn't go to church. Every Sunday, Biden and all the living former presidents go to church. Trump never does. He was asked live to quote a passage from the Bible and he couldn't quote one. You don't know anybody who's a true Christian and claims to love the Bible who can't quote a single line of scripture. My Catholic school training, I can still quote scripture all these years later. The thing about white Christian evangelicals is they feel like the country is slipping away from them too, and that's why they find a home, not just in rural America, of course, but that's where the highest share of white evangelicals live. And many of their precepts or beliefs, not if they're white evangelicals, but if they're self-described white Christian nationalists. And if you look at the polling by Robert Jones and the people at the Public Religion Research Institute, PRRI, here in Washington, D.C., basically they agree to any of some or all of five principles, including like we will no longer be a country if we cease to be Christian. In order to be a real American, you have to be a Christian. When the Bible and secular laws conflict, the Bible should supersede. And so there's a non-secular vocabulary there, and there's a non-secular belief about what the proper role is of religion and tearing down the church-state wall. And we think that's problematic for a secular and pluralist democracy. And when you have somebody like Mike Flynn said, well, we should only have one, there's only one God, so we should only have one religion, basically saying it's Christianity or not. And when you have Trump with a Muslim ban and his episode where he used tear gas to clear out the protesters to walk across the street to St. John's Church across Lafayette Park here in D.C. to hold a Bible aloft, which I think was a very clear signal. And what's fascinating is George Bush was actually an evangelical, whatever else you think about him. He was born again. He got himself clean and sober. And Trump got like 1 or 2 points higher even than George W. Bush. And he doesn't go to church at all and can't quote the Bible, which the Christian national scholars all say Christian nationalism isn't a religious movement. It's a political movement. And it's very clear by Trump's support how political it's become.
This is one of the interesting places where Trump revealed that something everybody thought was true really wasn't true. And we used to think that what Republicans would do every 4 years when they ran for president was what you had to do, which is that they would go and demonstrate to evangelical voters, who are one of the key foundations of the Republican Party, that they were personally pious, that they spoke the language, that they knew that they had been raised in it, or if they came to it later in life, that they were deeply immersed in that evangelical culture, and that they, in their own lives, lived in a way that cohered with the values that evangelicals held to. And it turns out that wasn't really what they wanted. And maybe they didn't even know it themselves until Trump came along. And I think that's probably what a lot of people would tell you who report deeply on this, is that they thought that was what they wanted, but then it turned out that Trump was really what they wanted. You remember that time when he went to Liberty University, and what everybody noticed was when he went to read a passage from 2 Corinthians, but he called it 2 Corinthians because he just wasn't familiar. And that was supposed to be evidence that he wasn't immersed in this kind of stuff. But what I think is really important is what he said afterward. He said that he read the verse, and then he said, "Is that the one you like? I think that's the one you like." And it was as though he was just saying, "I'm pandering here and we all know it. So here you go." And it turns out that they were fine with that. And what they really wanted was to make this kind of deal for power and influence over policy. And what really excited them about Trump, and this is, I think, where we can make the link back to the rural issue, is What they loved about him was that he promised to fight for them against their enemies, and that he was going to be, and I think you hear this from evangelicals all the time, that yes, he may not be our kind of person in a personal way, but he is going to fight for us against the people and forces that we loathe. And that was very similar to, I think, the reaction that he got in a lot of rural areas. He can't, as I think we say somewhere in the book, he can't tell a combine from a corn dog. But rural people saw in him somebody who was going to give a big middle finger to their enemies. And even if he couldn't really change the material conditions of their lives, which he didn't, that he was still going to offer them a kind of emotional satisfaction because he was going to be out there fighting against the people they hate and the people they thought him looked down on them and the people who they have been told for years are the cause of all their problems, even though, as we argue in the book, those aren't really the cause of their problems. Their problems are, in a lot of cases, basically with capitalism. And that's what has done so much damage to so many rural communities in a lot of different ways. But Trump was going to be the fighter against the people they hate. And I think that's where rural people and evangelicals, where obviously there's a lot of overlap, but that's something that they have in common.
Well, that was something that I found really intriguing about your book was the misplaced blame for the consequences of their votes. And this seems like a good place to talk about that. All the blame that goes to big city liberals and all of that, when it's the consequences of their own votes, their own representatives in Washington or their state capitals that arguably, you guys say, have let them down. So tell us a little bit about that angle.
Well, there's two absolutely absurd and mind-bogglingly absurd double standards at work here. The first, as you pointed out, is that the Democrats, who've won 7 of the last 8 national presidential popular votes, are incessantly told, scolded in fact, and not just by conservatives or pundits, by many Democrats like Tom Vilsack and others, write long essays saying the Democrats need to go to rural America and they need to listen and be respectful and not condescend, and then they need to cogitate and come back with a plan, and then and only then will rural white Americans begin to at least consider voting for them, right? But Republicans are never told that. They're never told that they have to reach out to their least likely voters, say minorities in the city, and they have to sit down and they have to listen and not condescend and try to get a sense of it and be respectful and then come back with a plan for urban revivals. Because even though they're the party that's lost the popular vote 7 of the last 8 times, they're not responsible for those people. But Democrats somehow have to bend over backwards on bent knee to try to appeal to the voters least likely to vote for them, even though they're winning the national popular vote majorities. It's an absolute absurd double standard. And the other one, which you reference, is the fact that every time you turn on talk radio or Fox News or ANN and anything goes wrong in the city, they love talking about problems in the city, not because they're worried about homelessness or poverty or crime, but because they want to make it a political issue, a culture war issue. They're not trying to solve it. They're trying to anger people, just like they're not trying to solve immigration. They're just trying to keep it as an issue. And so as soon as they point out homelessness in Nancy Pelosi, San Francisco or whatever, they'll say the Democrats and the minorities and the white liberals who live in the city, they're responsible for these problems and they should be held to account. Fine. They are. They should be held to account. The people who run the cities on city councils and mayors and the state legislators who and the U.S. senators and congressmen and congresswomen who represent cities, they should be held responsible. But you never hear the companion argument. You can live in a white rural county that's 90% white, voted 85% Trump, and has 20,000 or fewer people. And there are literally hundreds of those counties. And you could be represented from sheriff to Senate. And when Trump was president and vice president, literally by a nonstop chain of command of not just Republicans, but conservative white male Republicans from sheriff, superintendent, and school board president to president of the United States. And nobody ever says all these problems in rural America, they're the fault of white rural conservative Republicans, because that's who represents them. There's no accountability whatsoever, or very little accountability, but the Democrats are always held to account for any possible problem that ever goes wrong in any city ever. Why?
I also ask why, when two of the major issues I would think facing rural America are climate change and access to health care, which are both issues where Republicans are 180 degrees out of phase with their rural constituency.
Yeah. And as we traveled around reporting this book, healthcare came up again and again. It's a huge issue. There have been almost 200 hospitals, rural hospitals, that have closed in the last 20 years. And in a lot of rural places, healthcare is just really far away physically. And that creates a real problem. We were talking to one county supervisor in North Carolina who said, not only do we not have a hospital in our county, we don't even have an urgent care center. So if you need some kind of care, you may have to get in your car and drive for half an hour. And that's bad enough if you broke your ankle. But if you're having a heart attack, that's going to be a real problem. And so this is something that people brought up again and again. And if you look, for instance, at the Obamacare expansion of Medicaid, Medicaid is absolutely essential to the survival of so many rural hospitals, which are always financially on the edge. But with the expansion, you get a lot more people with health insurance. You get more people going to the doctor. That means that those hospitals have the revenue and they can stay open. And this is something where a lot in still 10 GOP-run states, they have not accepted the expansion. And the consequence is that a lot of their own constituents don't have the access to healthcare that they need. And there are problems like that that are built into low density. There are economic problems. There are problems like healthcare. There are problems with just building a business, that if there just aren't a lot of people around, it can be hard to get customers because there just aren't enough of them. But there are cases like that where the government has to play some kind of a role. And you see again and again these places, these times when the agenda of the Republicans who represent these areas is not the thing that is going to be most beneficial to their constituents. The healthcare is a great example. I'll give you one more quick example. In Texas, something unusual just happened, which is that state representatives who represent rural areas, for once, for a change, joined with Democrats to defeat a voucher bill that Greg Abbott, the governor, was pushing. And they understood that in a lot of the rural places, vouchers don't do anything for you because there just aren't any private schools. You couldn't use them even if you wanted to. And the public schools are an anchor in the community. And so you had this unusual situation where the Republicans joined with some of these rural Republicans, joined with Democrats to defeat that bill. And Greg Abbott swore that he was going to take revenge on them and primary them, and so that he could get a more pliable, farther right candidates to come in and replace those rural Republicans who had actually stood up to him for once.
It is a political problem for Democrats. And two names that come to mind to me of people who somehow are doing something right are John Tester in Montana and Debbie Stabenow here in Michigan, who chairs the Senate Agriculture Committee. She was endorsed by the Farm Bureau in her last three elections. And what are they doing right that most Democrats are doing wrong?
Well, I don't know. A lot of rural folks aren't too happy with the Farm Bureau historically. They feel like that's the Chamber of Commerce of rural America, and it's done maybe more bad than good, particularly in terms of its loan policies. We heard some complaints about the Farm Bureau, particularly from Black farmers. But I think rural politicians, I don't know, we shouldn't call them rural, but Democratic politicians who do well with rural people, some of them just have rural cred. John Tester clearly is a guy who was born and bred and lost part of his hand and worked on a farm and so forth like that. I think if you remember back then, the Salazar brothers, one was the senator from Colorado and one was a House member, and they owned a mint farm or something on the New Mexico-Colorado border. And so there are a sliver of Democrats who have built-in rural credibility. I think Steve Beshear, perhaps in Kentucky. Stabenow, I don't know her personal biographical background, but it sounds to me like she took the other route, which is establish a rural credibility by the issues that you decide to be a workhorse on, as opposed to just a lot of platitudes. And obviously Agriculture Committee, it's not the only committee that matters, but is a committee of greatest concern to rural America because of all the farming, of course. So there's essentially two ways, I think, for Democrats to stake out their credibility in rural America. One is to be from there. That's the easiest route, but you can't fake that. Although politicians like J.D. Vance try and succeed. We can talk about him. I thought you were going to bring him up for a moment. And the other is to prove your mettle by staking out an issue position or a policy area of expertise that matters to rural America and be an advocate there. And that seems to be the Tester seems to be model one, and Stabenow, as little as I know about her bio, I'm sorry, I don't. You guys obviously know her better. I don't know if she grew up in a rural community. Seems to have exemplified model two.
I would say that it shows just how high the bar is for Democrats. Like, you take a guy like Tester, like, you couldn't build in a lab somebody with more rural credibility. He's a farmer, as Tom says. He lost a couple of his fingers. He's got that buzz cut. Like, he is just oozing rural authenticity. And that's what it takes for a Democrat to be able to pass that bar, at least initially. And Republicans can do it so easily. One of the things let's take an example like Josh Hawley in Missouri. I love to make fun of him for this. He had an ad in his first Senate campaign where he said something about how he has three beautiful children. And then he says, just ask their mama. And I saw that and I was like, just ask their mama? What are you talking about, Josh Hawley? Like, you, your dad was a banker. You went to prep school and to Stanford and Yale Law. Like, why are you trying to pretend that you come from the backwoods? But that's the thing, that Republicans can get away with that stuff because there's a built-in assumption that there are kind of people, and Democrats have to be John Tester in order to get a hearing in so many parts of rural America.
That's a very good point. Now, in the few minutes that we have left, is there any way you can leave us with a little hope for the future? And this sounds like a pretty ingrained problem where the trends are moving in the wrong directions for a political and cultural reconciliation between rural and suburban, urban Americans. But is there, what's it going to take to overcome this chasm?
I think that we don't have a silver bullet, unfortunately. And there are a lot of progressive Democrats in rural areas who are doing real yeoman's work trying to organize and improve the situation of their for their party, their kind of outlook on issues. And it is hard work. Political organizing, when you're in a place where you're in the minority, that is tough. It's no fun to go knocking on 10 doors and 9 of them are going to tell you to get the hell off their property. But they are out there working. And as we approached the end of this book, all along we were saying, how are we going to close this? What are we going to say when this is all over? And we decided we're not going to give like a 10-point plan for economic revival in rural America. There are plenty of those out there. There are lots of rural economists who have come up with good ideas about reviving manufacturing and stuff. But that's not who we are. And the place that we arrived at was that there has to be a reimagining of what rural politics is, to bring politics back, really. And that's the problem in so many rural areas, is that, yeah, the Democrats have abandoned it, but the Republicans don't feel like they need to work to get their votes, and they don't. And so there's not much politics at all going on. And that's a real problem. And so if you could build some kind of a rural movement that really had its own demands and was coming to both parties and saying, this is what we need. This is how you can pander to us the way you pander to other groups, whether that's gun people on the right or labor unions on the left, whatever. Like, let's get some real pandering going on. And then they would be able to hold both parties accountable and to say, what have you really done for us? And you could build a cross-racial, cross-ideological rural movement that had its own demands that both parties really felt like they needed to address. And so that's the case that we make. Now, that might sound a little pie in the sky, and maybe it is. And those divisions are really firm. And it's going to take not one election, probably not two elections. It may take a couple of decades. But that's really the direction that I think you need to go. You need to bring a real kind of competitive politics where both parties feel like they have a case to make, and both parties are going to be held accountable for their performance for rural Americans.
Well, it sounds like they need to go into collab and create a William Jennings Bryan clone or something like that, right?
It's ironic. You talk about pandering, and Democrats gave up one of their big panders, which was having Iowa at the head of the parade for presidential campaigns.
Thank you. I'm always amazed at how quickly the time flies when we're having these interesting conversations. The book is White Rural Rage. It's a New York Times bestseller. Tom Scheller and Paul Waldman, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. It's been terrific.
That's a wrap for this week's show. Our thanks to Paul Waldman and Tom Scheller for their insights into a phenomenon impacting our national unity and our national politics.
Here we go. A moment on a tragedy involving a good friend of the podcast who is also a personal friend of Walt and Mark and mine. Our hearts go out to Dan Kildee and his family on the tragic murder of his brother, Timothy.
This is the second gun death that's very close to home for me in the last few months. 4 months ago, a good friend of mine was shot down on a Sunday afternoon while going door to door for a local political candidate in Lansing. The shooter was a 15-year-old who apparently was attempting a street robbery. Now we have this horrible tragedy impacting our friend Dan, one of the truly good and decent people that we know. It's just is heartrending.
Mark will be back from vacation next week, and hopefully the Republic will still be standing. Talk with you then.
A Republic, If You Can Keep It, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer, is a copyrighted production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.